You are listening to the Cycling Podcast, proudly supported by Lacca. From Milan-San Remo to Liège-Bastogne-Liège, the spring monuments are in full flow, and the Cycling Podcast is here for every gripping moment, powered by Lacca. Are you still riding without insurance? Is it worth the risk? Because one crash, one stolen bike, or a wrong turn could see you out of pocket fast. And that's where Lacca comes in, because it's insurance made by cyclists for cyclists. You chip in for the collective's claims each month, so when the claims are low, you pay less in premiums. And when it matters most, Lacca's got your back, with cover that goes further than you think. There's theft and damage at sportives and events, emergency cash if you're left stranded somewhere, legal assistance, and a 50% multi-bike discount. Plus, with zero excess, no depreciation, and optional licensed race and travel cover, you're ready for anything, whether you're riding your local club run or racing across the Alps. Don't wait until it's too late. Thousands of cyclists already ride with the Lacca Collective, and now it's your turn. For a limited time, listeners to the Cycling Podcast in the UK, Netherlands, France, Belgium and Germany get 30 days of free insurance when they sign up with the code TCP30 at lacca.co/TCP. So get covered now. Your future self will thank you for it. Full details are in the episode show notes. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, and here to wake you up on Monday, April the 28th, 2025. That is the proverbial painful morning after the intoxicating hedonistic night of hijinks and excess that was the 2025 classic season. My name is Daniel Freiber. I'm the host of this episode of the Cycling Podcast, in which it will fall to me and my co-host to shake you from your hangovers with the fail-safe elixir of good cycling conversation. Those co-hosts include a man who I presume is coming off a three-day bender in celebration of the of his team's, we'll get to that, victory in the Tour of the Alps, of which he was the architect, the mastermind, the inspiration. It is the Motown maestro, Larry Warbass of Michigan, the United States, and Tudor Pro Cycling. Larry.
Celebrating. Hey, guys.
Hey, guys.
Good to be here.
Celebrating with a yogurt on his very, very lovely terrace. There were yogurt jokes, bad yogurt jokes in last week's podcast, Larry, while you were riding and winning the Tour of the Alps. Joining him and me today, a man for whom three-day benders have another name, just the weekend. It's Lionel Burney. Oh,
that's a bit harsh. That's a bit harsh. Everything in moderation, Daniel. Yeah. Everything in moderation.
You would be the Pogacar on the Amstel podium, though, wouldn't you?
No, I don't like Amstel beer, I'm afraid. If they provided an alternative, very possibly, but it's not really my tipple, that, I'm afraid. Looking forward to a few days at the Giro, though. What's Albanian wine like? That's the key thing.
Ooh, well, we're staying on a wine resort one night. This is we mustn't talk too much about our lodgings at the Giro, because Larry will start getting pangs of envy. Larry, I was speaking to a team manager today. Well, we'll get to this in a minute about just how lastminute.com this year's Giro d'Italia is in terms of organization, things like the road book, which hasn't yet been printed. But I was talking to a team manager earlier today who told me that they have their hotels for the first 2 weeks. Not yet week three. I don't know whether they're expected to book for themselves in week three, or the Giro organisation doesn't expect that team to get past week two. But how much do you know about where you're going and what you'll be doing at the Giro?
I'm leaving Tuesday. I just received flight options this morning. That's about all I know.
Do you know what country you're starting in?
Oh, I mean, I know we're starting in Albania. And I think the first stage starts in Durres and finishes in Tirana. Second stage in Tirana. Third stage finishes in Vlorë or something like that. I don't know how to.
Very good, Larry.
I know a bit. Yeah.
Very good. Very impressive. I was going to ask you for three random facts about Albania.
I'll tell you three random facts about Albania. It's actually a really interesting place. Went there on vacation 2 years ago for a weekend to Tirana. It was like the second most closed country in the world until 1990. It was like a really crazy, I don't know, communist dictatorship.
Do you know the name? Yeah, I was going to. Impressive.
Yeah. Actually, we went to some museums. It was insane. If you get a chance when you're there, you really have to go to some of the museums in Tirana. Really, really cool. Really worth it. So, anyway, if anyone's going to the start of the Giro, a lot of cool sightseeing to do.
Indeed, Larry. I've been doing a lot of reading about Albania, and people are generally pretty captivated by it. I was reading something from an English journalist who went there in 1993 yesterday, said it's the sort of place that would make surrealists weep for joy. Kind of mind-bending, certainly was at that time anyway, shortly after the fall of communism.
It's still mind-bending when you go, like, some of these places. This guy, Enver Hoxha, he was scared of World War, like, deathly afraid of a third World War. So he was pretty much obsessed with bunkers. And there's something like 200,000 bunkers all over the country. And, yeah, some of the ones in the city are museums now, which are pretty cool. So we went to this one. It's like a 50-room bunker, gigantic. And, it's, like, right downtown. It's pretty much a full city block bunker, which is pretty crazy.
Probably the only country in the world with more bunkers than golf courses, I would say. I would guess. I'm just checking this now. I think it looks like there are four golf courses in Albania. chaps. Well, there'll be lots to say about Albania. We indeed will be heading to Albania shortly after you, Larry. We will be arriving on the Thursday before the race, which of course starts on the Friday. But before we get to all of that, we still, of course, have to revisit yesterday's Liège-Bastogne-Liège. And we have to cover some of the other news in the world of pro cycling over the last week or so, not including your masterpiece of a ride at the Tour of the Alps, which we'll also get to. So, Lionel, it is time for the newsette. What have you got for us this week?
Well, the contrast to Tadej Pogacar's not quite dictionary definition perfect spring. Jonas Vingegaard, the second favourite for the Tour de France, still, I think we can just about still call him that, can we? Very little evidence to go on at the moment, but he confirmed last week that he will not be racing again until the Critérium du Dauphiné in early June. Listeners will remember that Vingegaard crashed out of Paris-Nice in March and suffered concussion and some other injuries. There was a suggestion that he would ride for Visma-Lisa bike at the Volta a Catalonia, but he didn't take part in that race, preferring to prioritise recovery and training. And yes, confirm that he won't race again until the Dauphiné, which means, by my calculations, that will mean he would go into the Tour, assuming he finishes the Dauphiné, he would go into the Tour with 5 days of racing at Algarve, 5 days of completed racing at Paris-Nice, and 8 at the Dauphiné, just 18 days of racing, albeit 4 more than last year, when he only had 14 days of racing going into the Tour. I suppose we're not too surprised about this, are we? Because, well, we looked at the options a few weeks ago. What could Jonas Vingegaard have done? We speculated that maybe he would do the Tour de Romandy, which starts this week. But that can be a race that's affected pretty badly by weather. Perhaps not the ideal race for him. Visma-Lisa bike weren't doing the Tour of the Alps last week. They are doing the 4 days of Dunkirk, but we ruled that one out on the grounds of absurdity. They're also doing the Tour of Norway and the Tour of Slovenia. Tanks on Pog's lawn, maybe. But the Tour of Slovenia overlaps with the Dauphiné by a day, so he can't really do that one. He did release a statement via the team, or the team released a statement on his behalf with some quotes, which I suppose were from Jonas Vingegaard. He's saying that he has no further physical effects from that concussion. He's feeling good. He's also apparently been in a wind tunnel in Denmark preparing for the Tour. There'll be a couple of altitude camps between now and the Tour. One will be in Sierra Nevada before the Dauphiné. And then there'll be the usual Visma-Lisa bike pre-Tour camp at Tiene in the French
and
Alps.
He can't wait. He cannot wait to get back racing, he said. So see you in mid-June, chaps.
See you mid-June. Yes, another 6 weeks. I mean, in inverted commas, off. I mean, he'll be at an altitude camp. Reminds me of the lyric from the Eagles song Hotel California with altitude camps. You can check out anytime you like, but you can never leave.
So, a while before we'll be seeing Jonas Vingegaard. It won't be quite as long before we get to see the pink jersey, Larry. Who knows how well acquainted you'll become with the pink jersey over the next few weeks. Good news in that the pink jersey has finally a sponsor. We've been speculating about this over the last few months. There has been speculation that the Saudi Investment Fund, PIF, what does PIF stand for, Lionel?
The Public Investment Fund, Public Investment Fund.
There had been speculation that they were in negotiations with RCS Sport, who, of course, own the Giro d'Italia. That would have caused some controversy, I would suggest, if they had struck a deal. But no, alas, or maybe, thankfully, as far as a lot of people are concerned, it is not going to be the PIF or Saudi Arabia who is sponsoring the pink jersey, but an underwear brand. You might be familiar with the underwear brand Intimissimi, who over the last few years have also sponsored, or the last couple of years at least, have sponsored the white jersey in the Giro d'Italia. They will now be the sponsor of the pink jersey under a new guise, because Intimissimi have renamed their men's line and they are calling it Yuman, I-U-M-A-N. Not sure how catchy that is. Yuman, I've been doing a bit of reading about them. So they've just relaunched as Yuman, and their sort of pride and joy as far as their new product line is concerned is a line of boxer shorts called the Indestructible. I don't know whether whoever wears the pink jersey at the Giro d'Italia will be gifted some indestructible boxer shorts. I know that over the past few years, the white jersey wearer at the Giro has been presented with a nice sort of box of pyjamas and nightwear. So whether that will continue, we'll have to see. However, I do believe that RCS have had their pants pulled down a little bit by this deal, or in the course of this deal, because the previous sponsor was Enel, Italian electrical company. And I believe that they were sort of paying around about, should we say, 7 million euros for the privilege of adorning the pink jersey. And I believe that Yuman, or Intimissimi, will be paying considerably, considerably less than that. I'll just say less than half. So that probably explains why we're only finding out now at this very late stage what the name and the logo on the pink jersey is going to be. We've already had delays, haven't we, with the route presentation of this year's Giro d'Italia. I mentioned that Garibaldi has not been finished yet. We're only 10 days from the start of the Giro d'Italia. Garibaldi, of course, is the road book. Chaps, I don't know if you noticed, Larry, you wouldn't have noticed because I don't imagine you get these press releases, but Lionel, you might have got it. In the last hour, in fact, we had the announcement of something that's going to be called the Red Bull Kilometer in the Giro d'Italia. In every stage of the Giro d'Italia, there's going to be a sort of golden kilometer. This is a phenomenon that's existed in other races, but it's the Red Bull kilometer. And I'm trying to scan this very quickly as I'm talking, but basically, there are going to be bonus seconds at the end of the Red
that's
Bull
terrible.
Kilometer. Yeah, Larry. Well, let me you talk for a minute, Larry, and I'll see if I can make some more sense of this as I read the press release.
I mean, I don't know. Just like, these golden kilometer things are just a whole lot of stress, you know? I don't know. It's like, I don't know. It changes a bit the dynamic of the race. I think it's good in a race like, you know, Bink Bank Tour or whatever, Renui Tour, whatever it's called now, you know, because like, it's like a sprinter type of race and things like that. But now, I don't know, like, you're going to have these climber teams trying to pull back the breakaway to get 3 seconds. And, you know, like, I don't know. To me, it's just kind of like,
well,
Tell me.
Well, Larry,
me
hold more. Your indignation because, and I quote, the last line of the press release, get this. And for the grand finale in Rome, in the eternal city, where the best will lift the Trofeo Senza Fine, the Giro trophy, Red Bull will surprise the entire group with an incredible surprise. Wow. you don't get more surprising than that.
Okay.
Wow. Cool.
What like an hour's bonus for the 15th man over the line?
Yeah, let's hope
that would be classic.
Let's hope the surprise and incredible surprise doesn't involve the indestructible boxer shorts.
Yeah.
By the looks of it, Daniel, the golden kilometer, it's going to be time bonuses of 6, 4 and 2 seconds, but with the intermediate point, there will be the Red Bull kilometer will give an additional 10 seconds. Is this right? Am I reading this right? It's not terribly well worded. Hopefully the rule book will be a bit clearer than this. We'll work it all out. But basically, you're going to be sprinting for your lives, Larry, and all the GC riders are going to be wanting to be at the front. Since when are they not? Just on the pink jersey itself, does it conform to the accepted Pantone of pink jersey? It looks a little bit dark to me. Maybe it's just a photograph. I know it's got a nice outline of Italy on there. I think that is. And my other observation is that the words La Gazzetta dello Sport, the founding newspaper, the newspaper behind the Giro d'Italia, it's been shrunk down any smaller and you'll need a magnifying glass to pick out the newspaper's name on that jersey.
Yeah, allegedly, relations haven't been very good between La Gazzetta and RCS Sport over the last few years. That's a bit of a bone of contention. And just also on the sort of last minute nature of this Giro d'Italia, and more bad news for you, Larry. I don't know whether you remember the presentation in, when was it, January? Stage 17 was unveiled, and they also unveiled this new section or new variation on the old Mortirolo, and a new 3 kilometer section that they were calling the Recta Contador. Why was it named after Alberto Contador? Because in 2014, riding some sort of sponsors event for Tinkoff Saxo Bank, Alberto Contador rode up this sort of goat path alongside the main road that goes at the Mortirolo, and he sort of, well, it was filmed, and he turned to the camera at one point and said, well, this is quite hard. And consequently, the local mayor decided that they should honour and commemorate this wonderful moment by calling it the Recta Contador. 11 years later, it is going to feature in the Giro d'Italia, and work has started in the middle of April. Work started on widening the road because it is a bit of a, well, in Italian, literally, it's a donkey path up there. Mm. So the lawnmowers, the fly mowers have been out over the last few days. Let's see if it's ready for you and the other chaps on, what date is it? May the 28th, Larry, you've got that to look forward to.
Oh.
Clarifications corner, chaps. I've been looking more closely at the Giro jersey. It's actually a print of the whole world because it's the outline of Africa, I think, there. Europe's just above it on the front of the jersey. And the bonus seconds, it is 6, 4, and 2 for the golden kilometre, or the Red Bull kilometre, to give it its sponsored name. 10 seconds on the finish line of each stage as well, bonus seconds. So yeah, all to fight for every day, day, every day.
last clarifications corner. Apparently there's one golf course in Albania. The other three are mini golf courses.
Oh, wow. That's crazy. Guess maybe, not where you go on a golf holiday.
Maybe we should go and play all three crazy golf courses while we're there, Daniel. One each day.
Chute, chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is also sponsored by NordVPN. Now, in a little over a week's time, I'll be heading to Albania with Daniel for the start of the Giro d'Italia. And after 3 days in Albania, I'll be heading over to Italy for a few days, covering the race before heading back home. And one of the things that I need to pack in my metaphorical suitcase is my NordVPN subscription. I don't need to pack anything, of course, because the app is already on my phone and on my computer, which means that when I'm logging onto the internet in lots of different places, as I will be, I'll be accessing the internet on public Wi-Fi or in hotels or in the Giro press room, I will be safe and secure in the knowledge that NordVPN is protecting my private data. Important stuff like bank details and passwords and my online identity. You can use one NordVPN account on up to 10 devices. You can use it at home or abroad. And there are some other benefits as well, such as streaming your favorite TV shows or films or sporting events when you're not in your own country. You can simply switch location and carry on watching your favorite things without interruption. It's also the fastest VPN in the world. No buffering or lagging while you're streaming. Now, you can get a great discount because you're a Cycling Podcast listener. If you go to nordvpn.com/TCP, use that link and you'll get 4 extra months on a 2-year subscription. It's also no risk because NordVPN offers a 30-day money-back guarantee. So go to nordvpn.com/TCP.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step 1, download Rocket Money. Step 2, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step 3, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Well, chaps, started this episode talking about hangovers after the classics. We'll hear from a gentleman who was very much sort of hungover is the wrong word. And he wasn't literally hungover, but he was feeling a little bit down this morning at the end of the classics. Of course, the cycling season shifts gear, shifts sort of, well, context, shifts landscapes, shifts countries from now on. And, well, Larry, we're entering the period of the season when we expect you to be centre stage. But, Larry, I'm guessing you had a keen eye on Liège-Bastogne-Liège yesterday. Lionel and I already spoke about it at length in Arrivée. But I'm supposing that you were also watching.
Yeah, I did. I mean, I had to catch up a bit in the evening because... yeah, some people came to visit and stuff, but I rewatched all the most important parts, actually. So can't say it was a big surprise, but I just have to say it's still impressive how strong Pogacar is in the saddle, able to ride away from everyone without even standing up. So pretty crazy.
Indeed. I mean, one of the features about, I suppose, the morning... the coverage this morning, you know, reading whether it's L'Équipe or other websites in other countries, is yesterday left everyone sort of, well, talked out or scrambling. Well, not even really scrambling for superlatives anymore. Sort of resigned to the fact that no superlatives really exist anymore to do this justice or to provide any kind of new insight to what's been an incredible spring, what, of course, as we know, is an incredible career already. But I guess we've entered a new phase. I feel, as I've said that numerous times over the last couple of years, but we've entered a new phase of the Pogacar domination.
Yeah, I mean, we were trying to put it into context yesterday, weren't we, Daniel? One of our listeners wrote in this morning, Greg Tomlinson, with a couple of quite interesting questions. The first one, briefly... do you think Tadej Pogacar will feel that Milan-San Remo or Paris-Roubaix was the one that felt most like the one that got away for him this spring?
What do you think, Larry?
I think Paris-Roubaix, maybe. I don't know. I think like, well, I think San Remo. I guess the thing is with Paris-Roubaix, it seemed like he was closer maybe almost than San Remo to me. Like, it almost seemed like it seems like he has a better chance to win Paris-Roubaix than he does San Remo. Or it's going to be, I think he'll win both of them over the course of his career. but I think it'll be easier for him to win Roubaix than Sanremo. So I think the fact that it was his first Roubaix and he was so close to the win, I think that was like, I don't know, pretty big already. You know, I think he'll see that as like more achievable than Sanremo. And I think he probably is just more annoyed with Sanremo because he keeps trying and he keeps being unsuccessful. Not unsuccessful. I mean, you know, I'd still say podium and all this is pretty good, but yeah.
Yeah, that's the great unknowable about the Paris-Roubaix, wasn't it? Because the puncture undid him. It would have been fascinating to know what would have happened if they'd been together when Matthew van der Poel punctured a bit later on. What would have happened there? Would there, you know, that's the great unanswered question of the spring. I was looking back at Eddy Merckx's results, Daniel. Of course, he's the only man to win three monuments in a year, and that's something that he did four times in his career, 1969, 71, 72, and 75. And just comparing the results, in 1969, Merckx was first in Milan-San Remo, first in Flanders, second in Paris-Roubaix, and first in Liège-Bastogne-Liège. And that gives him a sort of cumulative position, a cumulative total of five when you add all those finishing positions up. Pogacar's cumulative total from this spring is seven. So you're in the same ballpark. In 1969, Eddy Merckx didn't start the Giro di Lombardia at the end of the season. But then in 75, he won Milan-San Remo, won Flanders, was second at Paris-Roubaix and first in Liège-Bastogne-Liège, and then was sixth in Lombardy. But when you look at that campaign in spring 75, it was coming on the back of having finished second at Lombardy to Roger de Vlaeminck. So he had a run in the monuments of second, first, first, second, first. I mean, Pogacar is up there in that very rarefied atmosphere. And if you take last year's Lombardy win into consideration, you know, he's been on the podium of, well, I think we said yesterday, didn't we, Daniel? Is it six monuments in a row?
Yeah. There was some talk as well. There's some talk this morning, chaps, as well, about how onerous this has all been and the 7 weeks effectively that he's been competing and winning this spring from Strade Bianche to yesterday. And it seems as though opinion is pretty split about how burdensome this is compared to a spring where he might do, I don't know, two stage races and a couple of classics or spring campaigns that he's had in the past, and how repeatable this is. I think it was either Machin or Giannetti was quoted as saying that, well, he hasn't even travelled that much and it's not that many days of racing. But I think, you know, the fact that he's been centre stage, and there is that point of contrast with Vingegaard all the time. And Vingegaard this year, you know, for whatever reason, because of circumstances, he's at the opposite end of the spectrum. He's completely sort of disappeared. He's nowhere. And he's facing none of the sort of, you know, the music, the spotlight, and all the pressure of having to perform every week. And it does lead people to wonder what is going to be the long-term toll in Pogacar's season, particularly bearing in mind that, in theory, we think he's got two Grand Tours ahead of him, the Tour de France and the Vuelta, plus possibly World Championships, maybe Lombardy as well. What do you think, Larry?
I mean, I think he'll be fine, you know. I mean, he's Pogacar. But, you know, I think the thing is now he'll have a really good break. He'll build up at altitude, and then I'm sure he'll smash the Tour. And then if he's going to do the Vuelta, it'll be sort of the same deal, you know. I mean, he'll have a break. Maybe, I don't know if he'll do altitude then, but you know, I think he'll have a good break. And then, you know, I think actually going from race to race, like the one days, when you do a bunch of one days, okay, I know maybe Giannetti said it's not that much travel, but it is a lot of travel because each time you're traveling to and from the race, you know. And I guess the good thing is he's probably still doing good blocks at home, you know. He's not doing huge blocks away. But, like, the one nice thing is if you do – say he has two Grand Tours left and he'll do a few one days at the end of the year. I mean, the cool thing is, like, that is not that much travel, you know. Like okay, yes, he's going to go to altitude, so he's going to have to go away, but I'm guessing, like, Urska will come for part of the time, you know, which I think, you know, being away from family, friends, girlfriend, whatever, is, like, part of the most fatiguing part of that whole thing, like going on training camp. But I just think, like, when you can really concentrate the racing in one block, even if you do a lot of racing, it's less mentally fatiguing. Like, it's extremely fatiguing because it's a Grand Tour and you're racing for 21 days. But, like, I think the fact that it's just all concentrated in one block, it almost is less, fatiguing on the head, I guess.
I guess mentally you're transitioning into the bubble. You stay in the bubble for 3 weeks and then you come out again. You kind of, there's a lot of things that are predictable about it, formulaic, everything kind of looked after you for you. Even just doing the monuments and even just going home in between them. Yeah, like you say, a travel day either side, isn't it? And then recon, orientation, moving around. Yeah, I can totally see how that would be more fatiguing.
The different coffee machine every morning in the hotel. Even that alone is fatiguing.
Going from chef to someone else cooking for you. It's not easy.
Larry, correct me if I'm wrong, but he's not using private jets, is he?
No, he's not.
I wonder when pro cycling, and particularly that team, will enter the realm of. Because, of course, that's commonplace on, for example, and it's not something that we welcome or we want to necessarily happen. We certainly don't want it to happen and become de rigueur in professional cycling. But, for example, in professional golf, it is de rigueur. Even the top 100 players in the world pretty much are traveling with private jets. So, I was thinking about a week like the last week, the Ardennes. Did he stay up there all week?
I mean, I would guess so, at food camp,
as you described it a couple of weeks ago.
Just funny, you said like private jet is like, so he always is, he's also traveling from Nice airport or whatever most of the time, right? And the funny thing is, like, he's like always sitting last on the plane or something for some reason. Like, I would say, like, if you go to training camp, whatever, it's like everyone almost flies the same day, or if you go to the same race, obviously, like, all the riders from here pretty much leave the same day. And I swear Tade is last row every single time, and he just doesn't even care, and it's funny because I think it was maybe when we were going to training camp this year, we transferred in Zurich and Cancellara was on my plane, and he saw that Tade was sitting, like, last row on the plane. He's like, this guy could fly private if he wanted, And it was just, like, the shocking thing of, like, I mean, to me, that also shows, to me, like, I don't know, he's just such a chill guy that, like, he could fly probably in a private jet. And instead, he doesn't care that he's sitting literally row 37th out of 35 in economy, I don't know. To me, that's kind of cool that he's just, like, still humble, down-to-earth guy and isn't too fussed by his travel arrangements,
Long may that continue. Chaps, Lionel, I referred to the post-classics hangover, and I said we would hear from a man who was feeling the post-classics blues this morning. It is time, the final time of the spring, to visit Hugo Corvitz in Corvitz Corner, and I would like to take this opportunity to just thank Hugo for his wonderful, wonderful contributions throughout the spring. It's been an absolute pleasure and a privilege to have the insight of someone who, as I've said many times this spring, is an oracle on all things classics and Belgian cycling. Here is Corvitz Corner.
Pay attention, freebie. Honestly, when I walked around the Boulevard de la Souvenirs and the Quai des Ardennes in Liège on Sunday evening, I felt a sense of depression. It's something I've had for the past three, almost four decades. I saw the team coaches drive away, some of the men's towards the Tour de Romandie, the women's back home. Cycling has gone from my corner to other places. It always gives me mixed feelings. And that's not because Liège-Bastogne-Liège is usually a boring elimination race, but spring went by much too quickly again. When I arrived at the finish, Tadej Pogačar was already waving the flowers. This time, I had deliberately chosen the women. The women's final had yet to begin. To be honest, that was a lot more exciting than the show that the Slovenian put on for the third time in Liège, Bastogne, Liège. What do I remember from this 111th edition? Question mark. That we don't get a jewel at all again, and that Remco Evenepoel still does not box in the same category as Tadej Pogačar. With two monuments, the Strade Bianche and the Flèche Wallonne, he's once again the man of the spring. And what about Remco Evenepoel, question mark? After his victory in the Brabantse Pijl and the catch-up in the Amstel Gold Race, Remco Evenepoel was able to keep up the pretense that he could be more than an ordinary sparring partner for Poggi. Only this cannibal has no opponents. When I heard on the radio that Evenepoel couldn't even put his foot next to Pogačar on La Redoute, I knew enough. I got the same vague feeling as on Friday, 8th September 2023, when Evenepoel completely blocked on the Obisque in the stage of the Vuelta a España to the Tourmalet under the force of Jumbo Visma. Enough day, as it turned out. Enough day, Evenepoel said again on Sunday in Liège. Remco Evenepoel's main problem is that he somehow got caught up in the wave of euphoria that the national media created after the Brabantse Pijl that was held without the world champion. Granted, someone who can only compete on 18 April is fresher than a glutton who was already racing on 17 February. But Remco's big problem is that he flew into the opening door of a postal van on 3 December and that completely disrupted his winter. Without a broad winter base, the chance of an off day is of course 100 times greater. And if it falls in the week of the Ardennes Classics, you can close the books. Certainly, against a Pogačar, who many are already claiming will be the greatest of all time, the new Eddie Merckx. That's possible, but sorry, Poggi, you are not even halfway through Merckx's list of achievements. The classics are over. On to the Giro d'Italia freebie. I can't wait.
So, chaps, poor old Hugo, feeling very sad this morning as the sort of circus leaves town, leaves Belgium. We may yet feature Corbett's Corner, have the odd Corbett's Corner at the Giro d'Italia, if the Belgians distinguish themselves in any way. But obviously yesterday, Remco Evenepoel's day off, his jour sans, was a big story. And, well, I also wanted to talk about a few teams who had a bit of an off-colour classics season. Obviously, UAE did very well, and Sudal Quickstep did less well. Of course, Hugo had reminded us earlier in the spring that, well, of Patrick Lefebvre's old maxim, that one shouldn't sort of draw any conclusions, make any judgments about that team's classics until the night of Liège-Bastogne-Liège. Well, the morning after the night of Liège-Bastogne-Liège, I think we can say that they had another pretty poor classics season. But there were other losers, I suppose, as well. Losers sounds very harsh, but Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe, for example, they made big investments in the winter. Their classics team, they came away very not only empty-handed, but I think sort of licking their wounds. And there were other teams as well. Ineos Grenadiers have had a brilliant start to the season. They've entertained us. They didn't win anything either. Of course, Pogačar and Van der Poel have kind of monopolised things.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Recency bias. Well, how you finish always leaves the lasting impression, doesn't it? And because of the way Remco Evenepoel kind of pulled up quite dramatically on the Roche au Faucon on Sunday, he left us with an impression that he'd had a bad day. But of course, They would have been pretty happy with how he'd gone, winning Brabantse Pale, his first race back in action after that training crash into a postal van door in December, and on the podium at the Amstel Gold Race as well. But slim-ish pickings for Soudal Quickstep, who we always expect to be huge players in the classics. But they did at least win Skelderprijs with Tim Melier as well. They were on the podium at Omloop Nieuwsblad with Paul Manier, young French rider who will win one of these type of races sooner rather than later. And Melier was also on the podium at Gent-Wevelgem. Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe slightly less kind of notable this spring, but ended on a bit of a downer as well, because Maxime Van Hiels, their kind of big signing, who they, well, what do? They kind of leveraged him out of his Lotto deal, signed him, and crashed in the Amstel Gold Race and started, perhaps ill-advisedly, started Liège-Bastogne-Liège and didn't get terribly far, pulled out of the race with his injuries in Liège-Bastogne-Liège. I would just like to mention, though, Biniam Gamay. There were a few performances from the spring that went a little bit under the radar, one of which was Gamay finishing 15th in his debut Paris-Roubaix, which was a good result. And, you know, when we were cooing around sort of Filippo Ganna finishing, I think, one or two places ahead of him, Gamay's performance there deserves a nod. I would also say, you know, we didn't give huge props to Ben Healy yesterday. A good result getting on the podium at Liège-Bastogne-Liège. You know, in the absence of Tadej Pogacar on yesterday's form, you could well imagine Ben Healy winning a race as hard as Liège-Bastogne-Liège in the future.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Finally, chaps, finally, we get to the main event of this week's podcast. Larry Tudor Pro Cycling's triumphant week in the north of Italy and the south of Austria. Victory, Larry, in the Tour of the Alps for your teammate, Michael Storer. But it was a team victory. That's the important thing to emphasize. And we're going to talk about it now because it was very spectacular. It was impressive and it was spectacular. I think I said to you in a message, Larry, that it was a gangster ride from Michael Storer. We talked about him a couple of weeks ago, didn't we? He's sort of a grizzly bear who looks like a teddy bear. And so it proved. Larry, these three crucial days where first Storer took the jersey, then he lost the jersey, then he took it back again. Take us inside the Tudor Pro Cycling team bus, take us behind the scenes and tell us your story of those 3 days.
So, yeah, I mean, I'm glad that, one, you know, at altitude, I thought he was in really good shape. And I'm glad to see that he really was in really good shape. And it wasn't just we were not in good shape or something. But yeah, he was absolutely flying. You know, we talked a lot about Pogacar, but I have to say Storer was the Pogacar of the Alps.
Storachar.
And, yeah, I mean, he was extremely impressive. So the day, the first day, like, I think it was the second stage that he won. And we had talked about it the night before that essentially if he was feeling good, he was singing to attack. And then he said he was going to practice the arrow move that I taught him, you know, which was like, he called it the praying mantis, but, you know, just essentially getting really low on the drops and keeping the head super down. Because when we were at altitude, we, you know, we were all, there was three of us, we were training together a lot. And so I would say Michael is not exactly known for his aerodynamics because he rides with about like 3 to 4 centimeters of spacer under his stem. So he's super upright, you know. He has these, you know, he has short cranks also. He was the original short crank guy. You know, he's been on them for like as long as he's been able to get them.
If I can interject, Larry, about his sort of how aero he is and his time trialing. He hasn't got a lot of time trialing pedigree. Probably the most famous or infamous thing he's ever done in a time trial was in the Vuelta a España. I think it was the 2018 Vuelta a España. Time trial in the hometown of Oscar Freire in Torre la Vega. And he was starting before his teammate Jai Hindley. They were both riding.
No, it was Johannes Frohlinger.
Oh, was it Frohlinger? Yes, it was. Frohlinger. They were riding for, I think that team at the time was Giant Shimano Sunweb. Yeah. And Stora took his bike, didn't he? He took his bike.
He did, yeah.
And they had to swap. He rode a couple of kilometers, he realised, and they did a swap on the road.
Oh, did he have to swap? I think they had to do a stop.
And I remember trying to speak to him about it the next morning and sort of going there with a sort of smile on my face as though this is going to be a funny story for everyone, and realizing very quickly that it wasn't a funny story.
Oh, really?
As far as the team.
I mean, anyway. I still find it a funny story because I just remember hearing from Frohlinger the story of he walks out of his bus and his bike just isn't there. And anyway, I don't know, I still get a good laugh out of that one. I actually never asked Michael about that story, but anyway, so yeah, while we were at training camp, we were doing these rides, and I don't know, I was showing him essentially that if you really get super aero on the bike, you know, if you're going 50k an hour, it's like you do 100 less watts than the guy next to you if he's not trying. So once he sort of wrapped his head around this, it like absolutely blew his mind. And then he started to practice trying to get aero. And he's like, I really need to try this out in the race. So he's like, I'm going to attack over the top of the climb and I'm just going to get super aero to the finish line. So he does that. And sure enough, he wins by like a really good margin, like 40 seconds or something, I think. Gets a little email from the UCI the next day saying that his position is a bit on the limit. Yeah, he didn't get an email. Someone got an email or something. Anyway, it was fine. He didn't do anything wrong. But, you know, the UCI like to come down hard on
these
errors.
Dear Mr. Stora.
Yeah. So anyway, that was a big success. So then the next day, you know, it was a hard day. And we were like, okay, it's not going to be the easiest to control. And so our team director goes, well, we just let a really big break go and we put in Florian Stork, who was like 11th in GC, and then we make everyone else ride, you know? And we were like, yeah, okay. I mean, like, yeah, that if that could happen, that would be awesome. But like, you know, I think you're dreaming, you know? So sure enough, it's a big fight. We're controlling everything. And then at one point, like a pretty big group goes and Florian goes, and then everyone's looking at us like, you guys are screwed, you know, like there's like 20 something guys in the breakaway and no one else realized that we had a guy in who was like the best on GC. So actually that was kind of funny because everyone's staring at us. And even like, apparently there was a Devo guy on Trek who had a laugh, like at our Devo guy saying like, oh, have fun today. You know, like, cause this kid had been riding the front the 2 days before. And then the funny thing is, our Diva guy goes, oh, no, like, we have someone on GC. And then that Diva kid wasn't laughing anymore, and he had to control the whole day again. So anyway, that worked out quite well. Then the day after was this really terrible weather, pouring rain, freezing cold. And, you know, it was kind of like a draggy, long climb at the start and then a long, long, long descent. And then we started a series of climbs. And on this long descent, everyone got absolutely frozen. And so we were right in the front, my teammate and I. And then at the bottom of the climb, Ciccone just started sprinting. And I don't know if it was because he was cold or he just wanted to try to blow the race open, but it was like 100K to go. And the race exploded and we got dropped, and it was only Michael in the front, which was not a very good scenario for us. And and then it was just like attacks. And Arendsman got away, had a lead of 4 minutes until Michael realized he had to go on his own. And then he attacked, dropped all the GC guys he was with, put like 2 minutes into all of them, and then finished a little over a minute down on Arendsman. So he lost the jersey there by 11 seconds, which he was extremely disappointed about. But in the end, I think was probably the best thing that could have happened, because that let us be on the offensive rather than the defensive the day after. And our team director, Claudio Cozzi, he came up again with like a crazy plan for the next day. It was like to put a guy, one of us, in the breakaway, and then have Michael launch over the top of like one of the climbs, and then have the guy from the breakaway wait, drag him across the second to last to the last climb, and then, yeah, hopefully be able to hold on to the finish. And somehow it actually worked perfectly. And so, yeah, honestly, it was like playing PlayStation, the tactics that the director came up with, but with, yeah, Michael going as well as he was, it actually worked. So that was pretty cool, because, you know, these are like tactics that you'd think would be awesome to do, but like in practice seems a bit ridiculous. And in the end, because he was in such good shape, it actually worked. So that was cool.
It's Larry, I can imagine it was quite a fraught situation as well, because I think there were five of you in the team, of which two were from the Devo team. Is that right?
So I was six total and two six. From the Devo team.
Okay, yeah. Okay. So quite difficult to control a race like that. A race as well, which is mountainous pretty much every day and hilly every day as well. And you obviously the most experienced rider in your team. So it was a big responsibility. I guess you were in your sort of road captain's role.
Yeah. I mean, I guess for me though, that like is kind of easy. It's more just like, yeah, I don't know. I didn't have as good of legs as I was hoping coming out of altitude. And so then it's a bit hard when you're somewhat limited in what you can do in the race. You know, like, I mean, I was still able to do a good job, but not as long on the climbs as I was hoping. And so that's like slightly challenging because, yeah, I mean, you have this sort of leadership role where you have to guide everyone, but like, you know, if you're not there, like the one day he was alone for like 90K, that was brutal, you know. But luckily, the other days it worked out quite well. And I mean, the cool thing was with the team we had, it was like really easy to sort of direct everyone. And everyone was in pretty good shape. And so we were able to make these tactics work, but really the only reason it all worked was because like Michael was really on another level. And so it was pretty cool, because essentially if he didn't win the race, it was our fault. Like we just had to set him up to be in a decent enough position to do what he could. And he was insane. So it was pretty cool to see.
You just had to point him to the phone box so he could go inside and put his Storachar cape on.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What was it like after that fourth stage though, Larry, when Tymon Arendsman, you know, put a lot of time into everybody and Stora was playing catch up? It wasn't quite enough to keep the leader's jersey. You all get back to the bus after the race. I mean, you said Stora wasn't happy. What's it like in that team environment with the sports director in the sort of the heat of the moment? Are there recriminations? Is there sort of, you know, is there a sort of decompression period before the debrief and then reset and go again? How does that all kind of work when you're on the back foot and still want to win the race, got to come up with something? How does in that sort of whatever it is, a few hours after the race, up to dinner time, I guess, and then the next morning, you know, how does that all play out?
Yeah, so, you know, on some teams, I think it would definitely take a turn for the worse. Like, you know, the ambiance can definitely go and, yeah, down the drain. But, you know, the cool thing was, is like, so, you know, it was really terrible conditions. And so, you know, there was even like a guy on Decathlon in the breakaway. He just dropped out of the race from the breakaway because he got so cold, you know. So it was like, it was a pretty rough day. And, you know, there were a lot of like leaders in the front group that were also isolated. And so, you know, obviously everyone was pretty disappointed on the way it worked out, in the sense that like he was alone for a long time. But I think we were also happy that he was able to save it as close as he was. And the director that we had, he's so, I don't know, relaxed or, you know, good spirited that, you know, he wasn't upset. No one was really upset at anyone. You know, Michael was like, you know, I know you guys did what you could, you know, and I think that's the thing. It's like, you know, that everyone is doing their best. And so if it doesn't work out, it's not because they didn't try, you know. And, you know, I think on a day like that with those like conditions, anything can happen. And so I don't think it's very constructive to essentially, you know, yeah, I guess punish people for, you know, lack of performance on a day that's hard to control. And so I guess the cool thing was like we weren't totally down like as a team. Michael was down that he lost the jersey. And he was more just angry in that he felt like the rest of the people in the race like ganged up on him. But I mean, you know, I guess if you're the leader, like it is kind of everyone versus you. So I would say like on the whole, we stayed reasonably positive. And then, yeah, I don't know, I went to see Michael that evening just to tell him that essentially I thought like he was actually in a better situation having lost the jersey, rather than if he had kept it by a little bit, because, you know, now it was kind of like it gave us almost the upper hand because it was Ineos who was going to be attacked and not us. And so, yeah, then I think it did set us up to do this pretty cool plan that the director had. To put someone in the break and then, yeah.
So how did the director kind of break that plan to the riders? Was that in the team meeting the following morning or was it cooked up overnight?
Yeah, yeah. So that evening we had discussed it. It was like, at first I was, yeah, when I had come to Michael's room, the director was already there. And then we kind of discussed that there. And then we decided like, okay, it would be either myself or Lucas Erickson because we were probably the most capable guys on the flat. And then Florian Storck was probably the strongest guy on the climb with Michael. So we thought it'd be better to have him like in case anything happened on the climbs before, you know, in the group. And so, yeah, it was Lucas and I. So essentially the director then went to Lucas as well. And then, you know, as long as everyone was on board with this plan, then it was cool. And yeah, so then the next day it was like Lucas and I watching for breaks. And so we were both following stuff. He got in a good move. So then I said, okay, you know, for me, it's also good to stay around Michael and sort of like, yeah, direct the guys. And yeah, it ended up just working out perfectly. So we were able to do a crazy, like full on sprint lead out into this second to last climb. And I mean, we were literally like sprinting and yeah, it totally blew up the peloton and somehow Michael was able to accelerate even after. So yeah, it was a pretty cool setup.
And then now he's going to win the Giro.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's hope.
Well,
I'd be okay with top five, to be honest.
Well, your horizons, his horizons, the team's horizons, as far as the Giro is concerned, must have broadened slightly, shall we say, or it must have, yeah, it must have given you ideas, particularly Larry, as you've just described. He's been given a new lease of life. He's discovered a thing called aerodynamics, which he didn't know about before, and yeah, and the world is surely, or the Giro is surely his oyster. But honestly, he has made a step up this year. I mean, he's around about the age when this might happen, should happen, sort of 27, 28. He's reaching his peak. Had a couple of years at Groupama where he did well at times. You know, he won the Tour de l'Ain, I think, twice for them. But there were other periods where he didn't necessarily deliver on the potential that they thought they'd invested in. But at Tudor, something does seem to have clicked. I mean, people might not have noticed so much last year, but he was actually really good last year as well. He was consistent last year. And then he's gone up another level.
Yeah, you know, I think there's one thing people don't always realize, and it's that I think you really need to be in, at least certain guys need to be in the right environment to perform at their best, you know? And I don't think he was particularly happy at either of his first two teams, you know, whether that was just fitting in or, you know, how he was treated or whatever. You know, I think the gist that I've gotten from him is like, this is the first team that he's enjoyed being on and sort of been happy at. And, you know, I think that has a lot to do with good performance. Because if you feel supported and you feel, yeah, I guess good in the environment that you're in, it's a hell of a lot easier to perform well in such a hard sport, you know? And if you're not happy, if you're a bit miserable, and, you know, it's easy to happen on a French team if you're a foreigner to be a little bit on the outside, you know?
To be miserable.
Yeah, no, I just mean like, you know, not necessarily miserable, but like, yeah, it's hard to fit in. And, you know, like, for example, for me, it took me a few years before I really felt like I fit in well at, you know, Decathlon, AG Tour or whatever. And yeah, it's not that easy. So yeah, I think this is the first team that he really actually felt super comfortable in. And I think that's also one of the reasons that he's performing better, because I think the potential has always been there. You know, I remember racing him when I was on Aqua Blue and we went to Australia and we did Harold Sun Tour, and he was super good. Their whole national team was super good. It was like him, Jai Hindley, some other guys. And I distinctly remember this guy though, being like super strong at this race. And I'm like, wow, these guys are going to be, you know, really good someday. Yeah. And yeah, sure enough, I mean, Hindley ended up winning the Giro. And then, yeah, Michael now is starting to come into his own. And obviously, you know, he won a couple of Vuelta stages and he's done some big things, but I still don't think he's reached his potential. And yeah, I think now we're starting to see that come to fruition.
Just on Stora, Daniel, I mean, we all remember the Vuelta in 2021, wasn't it? When we knew he was leaving Team DSM at that point, and he kind of saved the team's Vuelta that year with those two stage wins. And then last year flew under the radar a little bit, but was 10th in the Giro d'Italia riding for GC. So he's one of those riders who's got both possibilities, isn't he, Larry? He could ride a really solid GC and, you know, top five, you mentioned, a good target. But, you know, if it unravels at some point, he can also go off and, you know, target individual stages later in the race. I mean, he's got both of those options open to him going into the race, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I don't know what the team's objectives are or his personal objectives necessarily, but I would say to me, what I think would be a good objective to set out at the start would be, you know, top 10 in a stage win. And if you could get into the top five, that's like, you know, extra cherry on top, you know, that's the gold medal, you know, objective, I guess. But yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure, you know, if the team's going to put any numbers on it, but I think that'd be a pretty good way to look at it.
What, Larry, would you say is the, well, would be the concern or the weakness or the vulnerability? I mean, obviously the time trialing is the obvious one, and there are two time trials in the Giro, but is there anything else in particular that you would say, well, that is what he needs to overcome in order to, you know, achieve that kind of goal you said?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think the TTs are probably not his forte. Yeah, you know, like I think his power on the TT bike is nowhere close to on the road bike. And then, yeah, I don't know if it's just like, yeah, maybe consistency. You know, I know for him, like last year.
I thought you were going to say his team then. His Dominic's team.
Oh, yeah, maybe. maybe also possible. No. I think we'll have a decent group of guys around him. But, you know, I don't know. I think maybe just on some of the more tricky days, you know, like Strade Bianche, things like that, just to make sure that he doesn't lose time days like that. But yeah, I know, like, for example, last year he got to the Giro and he didn't even know he says he didn't know he was doing GC until he got there. And so, you know, I think he's someone who he'd prefer just to go for stages because it's a lot less stress. But when you're as good as he is, I think, you know, you have to go for the GC from the team's perspective. And so, yeah, I don't know. Maybe we'll see. I don't know if he, to be honest, like, I only raced with him in LaGuelia and Alps now. And in Alps, he was really good. And he was really good at following and always being in good position. We took every descent, you know, in the top five, top 10 positions. You know, and he did not seem limited in any way at that race, in terms of, you know, ability. But, you know, I guess the Giro is also a different beast in terms of positioning and fighting. And so I guess then we'll see, yeah, when we get there, you know, sometimes on some of these days where it's a big fight into the bottom of a climb or, yeah, into the finish, just to make sure that we can always stay together in good position, things like that. Because that's not always easy to do. So, but, you know, I would say in terms of physiology, I would guess if he even just stayed in the same shape he is now, he's probably physiologically capable of being on the podium because his numbers are unreal. And, like, I mean, I know, you know, last year we did Alps. We did altitude, then Alps, then Giro with Ben O'Connor. And, like, Michael is definitely a level above physically where Ben was last year. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think he's capable of big things. But, yeah, I mean, Ben is probably one of the gritty, you know, I'd say half of Ben's performance comes out of sheer grit and determination. And, yeah, I think Michael is enormously talented and capable of big things. So we'll see, yeah, if we could deliver him to, yeah, even a better result than we think.
Daniel, if we keep Larry talking another 10 minutes, we're going to get the quote we want, which is Michael Storer can win the Giro d'Italia.
Someone asked me that at the end of the Tour of the Alps. I was like, well, guys, come on, that's like a big that's a big question. But,
what a GC team the city of Perth could put out. Jai Hindley,
yeah, it's impressive.
Ben O'Connor and Michael Storer. Also, Michael Storer.
They could just put in an insane all-around team because I think Welsford is also from Perth.
Yes, he is. Yeah.
And I don't know who else, but they have like one or two other guys, I think.
Also, two other closing thoughts, Lionel. One, Michael Storer, I think he's going to win stage 15 of the Giro to Asiago.
Okay.
Just looked, had a quick look at the profiles, and that's my conclusion. Secondly, or thirdly, what a travesty that Michael Storer, Storachar, has a nickname, a proper nickname before Tadej Pogacar. Anyway, just Larry, the next, sorry, Lionel.
Well, I just wanted to mention Larry's former team, Decathlon AG2R, because there were actually two fantastic displays of team riding on that final stage of the Tour of the Alps, weren't there? Tudor Pro Cycling, of course, going for the GC. But up at the front of the race, we saw the experienced kind of journeyman pro, Nicolas Prodhomme, riding with the next Frenchman to win the Tour de France, I'm going to say. 18-year-old Paul Sexas, who's had he's had a sort of eye-catching beginning to his pro career, hasn't he? He was second in Paris-Camembert a few weeks ago. And I just wondered, Larry, you won't have seen it live, but when you were watching it, Daniel, you know, it seemed the obvious thing for Sexas, as the younger member of the team, to let Nicolas Prodhomme have his first pro win. You have to assume Sexas won't be waiting too long for a pro win. Prodhomme, who has 10 years on him, 28, never won a pro race I suppose it was a formality, really, that they would let him in inverted commas win the stage. But it was a very good display by them on the final climb, the final couple of climbs, really.
Yeah, I don't know if you saw the interview after the race, but actually the team wanted Sexus to win, and he was the one who said no. He thought that Nico should get the chance because, you know, he was always working for the team and he would have plenty more chances in the future. So I thought that was amazing. You know, like to me, that was like pure class from Sexus. And, you know, I mean, I talked to him a bit in the race and he just seems like a really humble, kind kid who I think he is destined for big things. And I just thought that was so cool to see him, give away his potential first pro win to a teammate who he thought, you know, maybe could have used it more. So that was pretty cool.
I'm just grateful that Sexus will not be in the Giro d'Italia competing for the indestructible boxer shorts or the Intimissimi gift pack. Larry, we should probably release you back into the wild. You've got a big week, final week of preparation before the Giro d'Italia. We might next see you in Albania next week, which we very much look forward to. In the meantime, Lionel, I think that's all from us, isn't it?
It is.
Busy week next week.
It is a busy week next week. I'm kind of semi-unavailable for selection next week. So you're going to have to busk the XL Giro preview episode. I'm not off to altitude camp. I'm off to attitude camp in preparation for a few days at the Giro d'Italia. I just wanted to mention a couple of things before we go, though, Daniel. A lot of listeners have listened to the bonus Kilometre Zero episode about Britain's only UCI-ranked one-day race, the Cycle Classic, which took place on Sunday, the same day as Liège-Bastogne-Liège, and it was won by Ben Granger, who rides for an Italian team, MGK Vis Costruzioni e Ambiente. Just getting my pronunciation up to scratch ahead of the Giro. Beautiful, wasn't it? Like liquid pronunciation there. Ben Granger won. He was 23 seconds ahead of a small chase group. He's a rider from Oxfordshire, came through Flavio Zappi's team a few years ago, and he's racing over there in Italy. From the photos I've seen, look very dry and warm and dusty in the East Midlands. Won't be long before people are saying that it's not a true cycle classic unless it's rainy and muddy. And just to finish up with, last week was the inaugural set of races in the Richard Moore Youth Theories of Races at the Linlithgow Circuit, the West Lothian Cycle Circuit in Linlithgow in Scotland. It's the first of five rounds that will all take place there over the summer. This round was organised by Roddy at the Stirling Bike Club and Wallace Warriors. Thank you very much to them for organising the first round. I'm going to run through the winners, give them a name check. The Youth C Girls was won by Lucy Dixon of Falkirk Juniors. The Youth C Boys was won by Ellis McCausland, also of Falkirk Juniors. The Youth B Female Race, Sarah McCormack of Edinburgh Road Club. That's Richard's old club, by the way. The Youth B Open Race, Gregor McNaught of Glasgow Riders. The Youth A Female Race by Lucy Sweeney of Edinburgh Road Club. And her teammate, Andrew Levinson, won the Youth A Open Race. So some great results there for Richard's old club, the Edinburgh Road Club. Well done to everyone who not just won, but took part. I'll find out a bit more about the Buffalo Awards, which were presented to the most aggressive, most attacking, most courageous riders a little bit later on in the series. One other little thing, if you want to go to the Richard Moore Youth Series Facebook page, you can see a lot of pictures that were taken. The podium steps were made out of old pieces of the old Meadowbank track, sort of wooden blocks made out of sections of the old Meadowbank track. Looks like a great event. I'm hoping to get up there for the August round, which will conclude the series later this summer. One person who did make it to Linlithgow last week was Edinburgh rider Callum Thornley, who's riding this season for the Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe Rookies. He rode and crashed in the under-23 Paris-Roubaix and was back home having a bit of R&R after his spring campaign. And the race organisers grabbed a quick word with him at the circuit. So this is Callum Thornley of Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe.
He's also, Lionel, before we hear from him, he's also just been promoted to the World Tour team.
That is absolutely right. So this is Callum Thornley.
Hi, I'm Callum Thornley here at the West Lothian Cycle Circuit tonight. Sun is glaring in my eyes, but I'll try and do the best I can. No, I'm here to watch my little brother race. Had a bit of a crash last weekend in under 23 Paris-Roubaix and got some unforced time off the bike. So I've come home and get a little bit of TLC from the mother and father and yeah, watch the racing. But it's great to be here. I've not been to this circuit before. I've seen a lot about it and heard a lot of videos and heard a lot about it, but I'm thankful the cobbles are not down this end, because I think if I saw them I'd have a bit of trauma. But it's good to be here, and especially since the race is sponsored by the Cycling Podcast, I'm a bit of an avid listener, to be honest, and remember when Richard died, it was a bit surreal, to be honest. And my dad also was the same. I think it affected him a lot. You know, you don't know the guy, but you listen to him every day and it feels like you know the guy, if that makes sense. But yeah, so we're down here at Buffalo Corner and under 16s are about to start, so quite excited to get things kicked off.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb and Lionel Burney.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US Soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.